Welcome to the No Direction Podcast, PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage. Remember, we con when you can't.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Nights and Nightmares. I am your substitute, Wes, for this panel, which is a problem because I'm not as good at horror as Wes is. Loss is a type of horror.
Let's all have a moment of silence for the departed Wes Schneider.
He's sitting right there.
Oh, that's just his ghost.
Welcome to Nights and Nightmares, Horror and RPGs. I'm Jessica Price. I'm Paizo's project manager.
I am Amanda Hammond-Coots. I am Paizo's development coordinator.
I'm James Jacobs. I am Paizo Pathfinder's great perfect.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about what horror is.
Yeah.
And we can talk about how to do it in RPGs.
Sounds good. James is famous and infamous for his Call of Cthulhu games that he's run over the years. I believe
like
there was one
on the
that Arian happened.
Okay, I'm going to tell people in a public space, in front of everybody, that I will have the new Horror of the Orient Express campaign up and running by Gen Con.
Woo! Oh my gosh!
Or perhaps just after Gen Con, so we don't have to stop in the middle of that. So within 22 days of Gen Con ending.
It was great, and we had 3 sessions, and we never did it again.
Yeah, because I think it was Gen Con happening. Everybody's
Gen Con
there.
So yes, yay! And you know, like, the eternal waiting is a sort of horror.
So is disappointment.
Yeah.
So I might be just setting up another type of horror.
So Wes made me read a page in a book once, and I don't remember what it was, but it was like an academic, I think super deconstructionist book on horror. But there was something that really struck me. The author said that to have really effective horror, you need some touch of beauty or the sublime in it. That if everything is just scary all the time, that it's not particularly effective as horror. What do you guys think about that?
I think that's absolutely spot on, because, you can't have light without darkness, you can't have good without evil, you can't have horror without hope, really. And you just look at a lot of the really enduring horror elements, and vampires come to mind, for example. Mm-hmm. Vampires are they're beautiful, they're elegant, they've got their shit together, they live in awesome castles.
Maybe not so much in What We Do in the Shadows.
Yeah. Well, you gotta start somewhere. I think that's absolutely true, and it's that juxtaposition. I mean, that's why comedy goes so well with horror. You know, stuff like Evil Dead or Tucker Hale versus Evil or Buffy or stuff like that.
Cosmo.
Yeah. Where it's like, you see something funny, and then something horrific happens, and it's like tequila and salt.
Humor and horror, I feel like, have a lot of the same structure to them, in that a big part of humor is the unexpected happening. That's a big part of horror. A big part of humor is also anticipation, right? Like, you know, there's a genre of humor where you know everything that's going to happen, and somehow knowing it makes it funnier. Like, there's an episode of a great TV show called Party Down, which almost nobody watched, but it was about a bunch of caterers in LA, and they cater the young college Republicans or something meeting, and Arnold Schwarzenegger is going to come, and of course the caterers themselves are all like out-of-work actors, and they're all like super liberal, so they're not getting along with the college Republicans all that well, and the climax of this event is supposed to be the president of the college Republicans presenting this flag that they got back from Iraq that's, you know, battle-scarred and torn and all that to Arnold Schwarzenegger. So, of course, inevitably, they spill food on the flag, and you know that they're going to throw it in the washer, and that's going to be terrible, and you see the bleach sitting on the washer, and you know that he's going to grab the bleach instead of the detergent, so, you know, the flag is going to come out bleached. And then, of course, it culminates with them really trying to substitute another flag in, And they needed to make it look tattered and stuff, so they light it on fire, and they look up just in time to see Arnold Schwarzenegger and all of the college Republicans watching a bunch of these liberal out-of-work actors that they think are, you know, ne'er-do-wells burning an American flag. And then every step of the way, you know what's going to come, and somehow that makes it funnier. And it makes you think of, like, there's a type of horror where you know what's coming, and somehow that dread...
Right.
And yeah. I think that might get to the... that might get to why there needs to be beauty or a touch of the sublime in horror, because there's a really thin line between desire and dread, right? Like, if you know that something bad is going to happen, you can tip over from not wanting it to happen to kind of wanting it to happen, just to get it over with, or just, you know, because you've been anticipating it for so long.
Yeah, absolutely. I think your comment about the build-up as well is really important. And, I mean, horror goes through, like, cycles and all that. You can see that in movies, particularly. And right now, there's a lot of, like, in the movie industry, there's a lot of movies that are not so much about horror as much as they are about dread. Like, The Witch is a great example of that, where there's not actually a lot that's actually frightening happening in there. And to a certain extent, when you get done with the movie, it's almost revelation. It's like, almost uplifting.
Yeah.
What actually happens at the end of The Witch, despite all the horror that led up to it. And it's really just this dread, like, you know, something bad is going to happen because, you know, there's these people in the middle of nowhere and there's woods and there's, like, their pet goat is acting funny.
It's that, like, that element. Deliciously?
Yeah, you know, like the taste of butter. And it's just the anticipation of that dread that is going to be happening. I mean, like, the Blair Witch Project is a great example of that. Mm-hmm. Really, not a lot really actually happens in that movie, but it's depending upon who you're talking to, it horror affects people different ways too. I mean, I think that's one of the most intense, frightening things I've ever seen in a theater. That and Paranormal Activity are both very similar, where not a lot actually happens, but they're super intense. Paranormal Activity made me afraid of my door. And,
doors are scary.
And it doesn't matter too.
Doors are also funny. See,
that's true. Doors are funny. But if it's closed, it's frightening because something might be in there. If it's open, it's frightening because something might come through.
Yeah.
And so it's really that buildup of, like, something's gonna happen. And then there's, like, be it a jump scare or a revelation or a false, you know, like, it gives you a chance to, you know, have a bit of relief or something.
That release is so important in horror and in comedy. We did another sort of horror panel earlier this weekend, and I remember reading about the psychology of horror movies just when we were doing horror adventures. And there was a note in this article in, like, Psychology Today that they found that people who enjoy horror movies tend to be moralistic. Like, they tend to want to see people they believe are bad people punished. And so... when you start looking at how horror movies are constructed, a lot of times there is something in the narrative that tries to justify the bad things that are happening to people, right? So, like, slasher flicks, you know, you have the girls that die earlier in the movie versus the final girl, and usually the girls... And incidentally, I'm not justifying this because it's a horror movie trope that I have major issues with, but the girls that die earlier in the movie tend to be shown as promiscuous, or they tend to be shown as, you know, careless, or they do, you know, the sort of stuff that has you screaming at the screen, why are you going in the basement?
Stupid or annoying or
right.
Any such, you know, negative trait, right?
Yeah, versus the final girl who survives at the end usually is virginal. She usually is...
The smart one. Yeah.
So, you know, but I think it's interesting that there is a sense of justice in horror movies, whether or not you think the criteria for it are misguided or not.
That's a great point, too, because there's a lot of, I mean, just recently, not recently, but in the last decade or so, there was a movie called Final Girl, and there's been a couple of shows that that take that whole concept and kind of switch it around to basically deconstruct that flawed premise.
Cabin in the Woods
is a great example of that type of thing.
Or You're Next.
You're Next.
That's amazing.
That movie is amazing because it starts out looking like a really stereotypical slasher flick. And then, like, the killers have the main character, like, cornered, and she's like, oh, surprise, bitches, I grew up on a survivalist compound, and, like, chops her, and then the whole movie becomes her hunting the killers.
So it's the same movie, but the horror is now happening now. It's interesting that you get one generation's take on horror informs the next generation's, and so it's just
a conversation.
Really, yeah. That's an interesting way to put it.
But so, how do we do horror in RPGs? Because there are a lot of factors that complicate it, right? With a movie, with a book, the director, the author has really specific control over what you're seeing at any given moment, right? They control where the frame is, they control what's outside the frame. Not being able to see outside the frame is a major source of tension. Jump scares, you know, stuff that you did not know was there, suddenly being there. And we're going to talk a bunch about consent, but let's save that for the second half of the panel. In RPGs, it's harder, right? Because an RPG is an exercise in collaborative storytelling. Your players are, if you're GMing, your players are participating in determining where the story goes. And more than that, any character's player can do anything at any time, right? They have pretty much complete freedom within the realms of what's possible for their character, right, to decide what they're going to do. So you don't have the same sort of control. The fact that the narrative is participatory means that you can't do the same sort of things to players' characters that you can do to movie characters or novel characters, because then it becomes not fun for players. There are games in which your character getting killed off, dying horribly, are part of the fun. Like Kingdom Death is basically the story of how your character died horribly. But that's not Pathfinder, right? Pathfinder is largely about empowering players' characters. So, you know, the constraints on how to do horror, you can't use a lot of the same techniques that people doing the Pathfinder have available to them. So,
yeah, it's true. You can do things like turn down the lights or use mood music and stuff like that. That works for some groups and other, and not so much for other groups. You really, so much of a horror game, and I know you said you wanted to keep the consent thing there, but I think that's important to hit right at the start, because you need your group to buy into the fact that if you're going to do a horror game, they need to want a horror game. And that's the same if you want to do a comedy-themed game and everybody's, you know, joking about stuff. Everybody needs to be on the same page. And that's the first most important thing for a horror game, because you need to be able to trust each other. And if you don't trust each other, you probably should be gaming together in the first place. But that's even more so when you're doing content that is so, you know, intense, like horror. And even to a certain extent, this came up in that Wolfgang panel, where it's the flip side, where if you're running a campaign where there's a lot of like romantic relationships between characters and NPCs and stuff like that, that also drives upon really powerful emotions that you really want people to have their buy-in and be comfortable with, and trust that you're not going to do something creepy or disturbing or whatever. And so that's really important. But I know in honor of Wes, one thing that he likes bringing up is this game Dread. And how many people have ever played Dread? Awesome. So you should all, the rest of you should all
should
play,
all
Dread.
Play Dread.
Dread is
Dread's
the
great.
Most perfect marriage of theme and mechanics I have ever seen in a tabletop game. Mm-hmm. It's not a system. It doesn't have the flexibility of something like Pathfinder, where you can play a lot of different genres. It is really designed for horror, action, suspense. But the central concept of Dread is you have a Jenga tower, and every time your character wants to do something, you have to pull a piece from the Jenga tower and put it on top. If the tower falls down, your character dies, or something similarly horrible happens. So the nerves and the tension of trying, you know, it builds as the game goes on, because the tower is getting taller and more rickety and has less of a secure base. And so also, if you're trying to do something really difficult, like you're usually doing in the climax of the game, you don't just have to pull one, you have to pull three. I'm looking at people,
it's a really tense idea, because just the way stories work, when you start out, you got little risks happening, but by the end of it, you're taking, these are the big life and death stuff, this is the end of the world type questions, and by that point, the Jenga tower is like, and
it's so scary.
It's super, I mean, Wes was saying one of the things he likes to do when he's playing is he just sits back and watches the players. When they start, they're all like, you know, sitting around the game, like, flopping around. But by the end,
nobody wants to touch that table. Like, yeah, everybody's like sitting on the table. Back.
You can,
it's
also, one of the interesting mechanics of Dread as well is it allows you to become like the martyr or the hero or something like that. Because if you just knock the tower down, mm-hmm. purposefully, your character's doomed.
But
you succeed dramatically.
And in a way that has saved the other players. So it allows you to take that agency of, we're all going to die if I don't throw myself into the mouth of this beast and distract it so that the rest of my friends can get away.
But be careful, because as I learned playing Dread, if you get to that point and it's obvious that there's no good solutions left and you want to be that person, just knock the tower over. If you jab your finger at it, just do that. You can miss and hit the base and it gives you a blood blister. And it launches that piece of puzzle against Jessica.
Oh, right. I remember that. That was terrible.
Yeah, that was, I did save the party.
It did.
My
it did.
Finger.
Got practical tips. James Jacobs.
Yes.
But it's interesting where it came up, agency, which I think is really key in creating a sense of horror in RPGs, is denying the character agency, right? Because, I mean, a big part of what's scary in a horror movie is either that you don't have the power to do what you need to do, or that you don't have the knowledge to do what you need to do, or that, you know, basically whatever you do goes wrong somehow. And so one of the ways that you can immediately create tension in a game is to have the characters know that they have, you know, particular character abilities or particular powers, and then take those away somehow. Like, who here has played the original BioShock? Okay,
yeah.
So that, I actually had to stop. I played it when I was living in a house in Capitol Hill with like 8 housemates, right? And I came home and I'd gotten my copy of BioShock and I was really excited to play it, and I got home and nobody else was home. And I start playing it, and you get to the part where you're in the bathysphere and the splicer starts cutting their way through and you have no weapon, and as a first-person shooter player, you expect to have a weapon, but like you can't even punch anything and that thing is coming in. I had to turn it off and wait till like at least one other person got home. I was so stressed, right? And I mean, like, if you're a first-person shooter player, that's the scariest thing. It's like, I don't have a weapon. What do I do?
Yeah, and that's something, like the Call of Cthulhu game, it's probably, I think that's probably my favorite role-playing game, even though I work for Pathfinder and all that.
It's a beautiful system.
Yeah. The thing that's, one of the things that's beautiful about it is that it takes agency away from players who are used to, like, the fight, build your character, get more powerful thing. When you make a Call of Cthulhu character, that's pretty much as tough as you're ever going to be. And in fact,
it's all downhill.
Yeah, it's all downhill because if you can get stabbed by a knife and the knife does 1 to 10 points of damage or whatever, and it's going to take 1 to 10 weeks for you to heal that damage. And it makes an entirely different sort of play base where it's not so much the survival of your character as much as it is seeing the story through to the end. And since it takes away the agency of being able to do all this fireball type stuff, and, you know, crazy attacks and all of that, it makes you play the game very differently. You can still do horror-type things in a game like Pathfinder, which is something we do an awful lot. We just did with Strange Aeons. We've done with a lot of adventures. We got the Book of the Damned coming out, which is filled with all sorts of darkness and evil and stuff like that.
I don't know why he's looking at me, you guys. No idea.
Man, there's a darkness in her.
There is a darkness. So those types of things can still work, but again, you need to have the player's consent. And that's not just the consent that they are here and they want to get scared, but that they have the consent that they're not going to make a character that is specifically trying to undermine the values of what you're trying to do. So.
Yeah. I mean, so we have a lot of, we tend at PaizoCon to have a lot of panels about, like, basically not being jerks to people you're playing games with, whether those are diversity panels, whether those are panels on resolving conflict. And when Wes proposed this panel, he was like, I want to talk about consent in horror. If you've read Horror Adventures, there's a short but pretty meaty chapter on it. And I think it's something really important to talk about because participatory narratives, interactive narratives, narratives where you are fully in control of your character in a way that you're not in a video game, right? So we have media that you consume completely passively, right? You go watch a movie, and there is no real way in which you're interacting with
or
the movie.
Or like reading a book.
Yeah, or you're reading a book. There's no way in which, other than sort of what you put into it emotionally, there's no way in which you're directly involved in the narrative. And then we have what my anthropologist friend likes to call participatory narrative, which you see primarily in political and religious ritual, right? Which is a way to make a story that happened a long time ago, or maybe didn't happen at all, but is a defining story for a particular culture, a particular political system, a particular religion. It's a way to make that meaningful to people, right? So, but you're still not, the story is still the same no matter what, right? No matter how many times you do the Stations of the Cross, spoiler alert, Jesus still dies. Sorry, did I write that for you? No matter how many satyrs you go to, the Jews are still going to leave Egypt. What we have with games is something kind of new in that it's an interactive narrative. Your actions can change the story. But that also means that it's personal in a way that passively consumed narratives are not, right? This is, in some sense, happening to you. Right? It's happening to your character, who's a projection of yourself, but, like, you're deciding everything that your character does. And a lot of times, like, you're directly playing your character. You're speaking for your character. The GM, when they're telling you what happens to your character, is speaking to you. It's a character that you have come up with. So it's personal in a way that just watching a movie isn't, right? Somebody getting their throat cut on screen, not the same as your character getting their throat cut. So I think you have to be careful when you're doing something that deals with horrific things happening, not just, you know, as background for the world or in myth or whatever, but to players' characters. You have to be careful in a way that you don't necessarily when you're doing a more passive form of media, because it has the potential to really affect the players negatively and make it not fun for them. So, how do we do that responsibly? I just talked a lot, so.
Not. All right. So yeah, like these guys said, and building off of what Jessica said about making sure that your players know exactly where you're going, consent is extremely important, particularly if you're running Pathfinder, because if I've read the room correctly, it looks like most of you are interested in running horror games in Pathfinder, or playing horror games in Pathfinder. Is that fairly accurate? So Pathfinder is, you know, at its core, a heroic adventure game, right? It's about, you know, killing monsters and taking their stuff and doing cool things and being a hero. It's not necessarily always about, you know, horrific environments and being terrified and having, you know, ghosts and undead creatures and hauntings and, you know, these deep psychological themes that happen in horror games. So you really need to assemble your group with your game in mind, and, you know, don't just say, hey, who wants to play Pathfinder? Say, hey, who wants to play a horror game? And get as specific as you possibly can. Who wants to play a horror game in a haunted, that goes through a haunted prison? Who wants to play, you know, a horror game that involves body horror? And you don't have to give any spoilers, but just sort of calling out the genre of what it is going to attract the type of people who actually want to play your game. The last thing you want to do is spring it on somebody. There are a lot of, like, very inexperienced GMs who think that it's a good and a fun thing when the players are taken by surprise and shock and, you know, are confronted with terrible things they didn't want to think about, and that is absolutely not what you want to do. That is the first and the biggest way to make somebody not want to play this game anymore, make somebody feel uncomfortable, lose a friend even. So you want to be as active and you want to be as clear as possible when you're putting that group together. And then having a conversation with each of those individuals that, you know, you've assembled your group, you've got four or five people, talking to them and just saying, hey, you know, here are some of the things that we're going to cover. Is there anything that you want me to know that you're not cool with? And there might be something, like there's somebody that I know who is very not into zombies, and they like horror, but they cannot handle zombies. So it's like, okay, if you're planning a campaign where there's hordes and hordes of zombies all over the place, maybe this is not something that player wants to do. So if you can communicate that at the very beginning, then you can get a group that has 100% bought into what you're doing.
And I think you probably all know this, but it comes up every so often when we talk about content advisories. Unless you are actually a licensed therapist, is anybody in this room actually a licensed therapist? Okay, then I don't want to hear any stuff about it's good for people to confront their fears, it's good for, we're going to use it as, you know, we're going to desensitize people to things they're traumatized about through this game. No, you're not. Just
you're
don't.
Just going to make it worse.
You're going to make it worse.
You're going to hurt your friend.
Yeah, and so, I mean, when we talk about trigger warnings, they've gotten a negative rap in a lot of cases because it's like, oh, having a trigger warning means that you can't do this thing or that this person can't participate in this thing. That's not what this is, and that's why I tend to use the term content advisory. It's letting people know up front that there's going to be this genre of stuff in here, there's going to be this particular thing that a lot of people have trouble with, allowing them to opt in, allowing them to say, like, and allowing them to talk to you and being like, hey, I don't care if torture is a plot point in here, but I don't want to hear it described in detail what's happening, right? And it's something that with horror adventures we had to spend a lot of time talking about and actually had some, like, pretty heated discussions internally was, where is the line between, on one hand, this is just dungeon dressing, this is just stuff that we acknowledge happens in the world, and on the other extreme, this is something that we are going to give characters mechanics to do, and in fact, we're going to make it a mechanically optimal way to get stuff done, right? Like, there was a period of time in which we had a torture subsystem in horror adventures, and, you know, a couple of us looked at it and were like, this makes torturing people a mechanically optimal solution to pretty much every adventure path.
Yeah.
No. And so, you know, it was a line we navigated. Like, torture happens in our world. If you go into a dungeon, you might see an Iron Maiden in the corner of the dungeon. But we're not going to give you rules for how to use it, because we don't want to encourage people to be doing that to other people's characters. We don't want to encourage people to be doing that to NPCs, right? And I mean, you can add it, like, if you really want to do that, that's on you. You can certainly add it in if you're playing in an evil adventure path.
I think that the solution that, because I was on the periphery of horror adventures, like, kind of watching, like, through the window. I think the solution y'all came up with was great, because there still is rules for, like, what happens if you get buried alive or get, like, a guillotine or something like that, which is still, to a certain extent, torture. But it was not presented as a way, here are rules for you to use to get a positive out of the game.
Yeah.
It was more, here are rules to, it was treated more like a hazard, basically.
Like traps.
Or a trap or something. Here's something that you need to avoid, and it focused on, here's how you survive it. Here's how you can endure it. Here's how you can escape it. Rather than here's how you use this thing to you know, do something distasteful or something like that. To pull back a little bit as an analogy, I think. So one thing that we haven't done, actually, I don't think we've done this in Paizo for a long time. The Thanksgiving Jones Soda taste test is gross.
While.
So I don't think we haven't done it in a while because it just got gross.
On a lighter note about torture.
Yeah, exactly. So we had this tradition. Have you heard about the Jones Sodas? Like, they have turkey flavored soda and Brussels sprouts.
I bought the entire Thanksgiving set.
Exactly. So they have that whole thing, and Eric
and
bought
that
thing and basically brought it. Was this is early Paizo days, and he brought it in, and he's like, we're gonna have a taste test where we sit down and we taste Brussels sprouts and country gravy and butter flavored soda and all this stuff, and we're gonna see which one's the worst. And it was actually pretty fun. We went through, we took sips, and some of our sodas and Brussels sprouts tasted like Taco Bell, and it was just the tears. At the end of it, we did a suicide. And then everybody, like, this is back in the early days of Paizo, we were putting in dollars and quarters and stuff like that, because that's what we could afford. And we had a stack of like $40, I think, at the end for whoever would drink it, and Wes needed a lot of money. He took that whole thing, took the money, left the room. Anyway, whatever happened outside of the room is Wes and his story. His personal horror. But that's a perfect case of consent, because we all knew going in that we were going to be drinking soda pop that tastes like Brussels sprouts. If Eric had brought us in and says, I've got a bunch of new sodas that we want to taste, and presented like a wine tasting type thing, and taking the labels off and all that, I was like, oh, this is kind of green soda. I'm expecting elderberry mint. And as Brussels sprouts, that's horrible. You know, that's the type of thing. Like, you just poisoned me, Eric. And it's still, I gave him consent to join his taste testing thing, but it was deceptive, you know. And so you want to do, in a horror game, you want to let people know that this is the goal of what we're doing here.
And that doesn't mean spoilers. That doesn't mean telling them what the entire plot is going to be. It means telling people what genre of stuff is going to be in there. I think we'll do...
I was just going to comment, kind of like a movie rating system.
Yeah,
almost.
Exactly.
Like,
or like,
you know, there's going to be violence and gore.
Yeah.
You don't need to give away what that is. Just that.
Like, we're at the beginning of an HBO episode, right? If it's Game of Thrones, you're like, oh, we're getting all the stuff in this one. Right? But it tells you, like, what kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
So you know that if you don't, if you're not in a good place to be watching a show that shows sexual assault, this episode of Game of Thrones, and honestly most episodes of Game of Thrones, are probably not, you know, something you want to watch this week. But it's basically just empowering people, you know, to choose to participate in stuff that they feel okay with participating in, or to choose how they participate and how they engage with it.
So, to talk a little bit more about how you inject horror into your games, it doesn't always have to be something that is like violent or gory or something like that. It's really comes back down to the horror is most effective when it's like we were saying earlier, the anticipation and the dread of the unknown. And that's, I think, my favorite author, of course, H.P. Lovecraft, says that the oldest type of horror is this fear of unknown. It's whatever it is, if it's something you don't know what it is, that's frightening, because then your imagination takes over, and whatever you think up is worse than what somebody else can tell you, because it's tailored to you. And one of the things that happens in Pathfinder is it's all there in the books. You know, if you want to know what a monster is, you pick up the best tree and you read about it. If you want to know, you know, how traps work, you read about traps and all that type of stuff. And when you're running a horror game, one really, really easy way to start building that dread, and actually a pretty safe way too, is when the monsters attack, you don't tell the PCs they're being attacked by orcs. You describe the orcs. You say there's this huge, burly, tusked humanoid. He's got like all this knotted hair, and he's got a shield with like a bloody handprint on it or something like that. And he's running at you with a sword or whatever like that. And you can even go further and say that he has three eyes. And all of a sudden, everybody's like, oh, it's just an orc. You say he has three eyes, and people are like, we don't know what this is.
Yeah.
And at that point, everything starts, and that's just a really subtle type of way to do it. You can also just play with expectations. Like, everybody knows that when the GM calls for an initiative check, you know, combat is about to start. You know, and everybody gets all excited at the table and all that. But it's also more subtle. You can, like, be exploring it, having the player characters explore a castle and all that, and then you can say, all right, everybody, make a will save. And then you go around the table, and they all tell you what the numbers are, and you write the numbers down, and you just continue the game.
Yeah.
There was nothing going on with that will save. But the player characters don't know that. They're at this point, it's like, is there a ghost trying to come out? And you can do that with perception checks, work really good.
Anything.
Anything.
Especially if some rules high, then they're terrified.
If it's really high, or you can do something like, I think Wes was one that told me this story, where it's basically you take everybody outside, you take one person out of the room, you say, so is the game going really well? Are you enjoying it so far? Yeah, okay, that's good. And you go back inside, and what did the GM want to talk to you about? Oh, nothing. And again, you want people to have consent and trust in a lot before you start gaslighting like this, but at the same point, it can be...
There's a difference that is really fun to play with between trusting the other people at the table and trusting the GM, right? Which you absolutely want to preserve that trust, right? It's not fun if you're sitting next to somebody you don't feel like you can trust in real life, right? That's different from whether or not you trust their characters. That's different from whether or not you trust NPCs.
Right,
and one of the types of horror is, and I don't know what to call it as a genre, but or even really as a trope, but where you have to basically make a deal with the devil, right? You basically have to conditionally trust somebody you know is evil. And so, you know, like the, vampires are a great example, like, not, you know, not sexy vampires, but, like, this creature might kill me, but, like, we've been forced together from necessity, and, like, I don't know whether I can trust them, and I have to sleep in the same campsite as this person who might kill me, right? Traveling with an NPC that you can't trust is something that creates dread. Suspecting that maybe one of the other characters in your party who's gone outside to speak to the GM and come back and been sort of cagey, like maybe is mind controlled, or maybe, you know, something's happened where, like, you don't know what they're going to do now. You don't know that they're necessarily going to act in the party's best interests. Great way of building tension.
Yeah, and as the GM, when you do that, you want to definitely make sure, watch the players, not the characters, watch the players. And if things starting to get like people are yelling at each other, arguing and stuff, you want to there was actually in the Curse of the Crimson Throne hardcover a lot of these sort of like, I guess, gaslighting ways where you can make people roll checks and stuff like that and doubt what they're seeing and what's going on. I introduced him to Scarwall, where there's this phantasm type trap. And it's the type of thing like where you'll have one character see like a ghost jump out of a closet or something like that, and everybody else doesn't see anything, and so you're not really sure who's been told the truth by the GM, because you're their window into the world. at the same point, you can use these types of things to set up like story elements, and they can learn like maybe the ghost that jumped out of the corner was like a maid that was like hiding in a secret closet when the castle got attacked by the orcs, and that can give them a clue that there's a secret door there for them to look for too. So there's all sorts of different things you can do with it.
Getting back to horror and the sublime or the beautiful, like, also think about what are you offering players to keep them engaged as terrible stuff happens to them? I mean, there's times when it's fun to just, I mean, like I said, King of Death is a game about how your character died horribly, and you know that going in, and the ways the characters die are interesting. But also think about, you know, I mean, part of what makes Lovecraft effective as horror is that it promises you a glimpse into a reality that is bigger and older and more mysterious than what humanity thinks history is. The twist is you always find out that that's horrifying, but like, if you look at The Exorcist, right, it incorporates real-world mythology, and it incorporates, like, The Exorcist is a movie with a really religious worldview, not just because it involves priests, but the narrative itself believes in God, believes that God is good, but believes that demons are bad, right? But so it offers up, you know, little glimpses into maybe how cosmology works, right? Like, there's I think one of the existential horrors of The Exorcist that you sort of have to accept its worldview to be horrified by. I'm not saying that you necessarily believe it, but I'm saying that for the duration of watching the movie, you watch the movie as if you had the same beliefs as the movie, is like, why are demons? Like, they used to be angels. They used to be creatures that actually knew how the universe worked and, like, stood in front of God and, like, and went evil. Like, what did they know? you know, like, it on one side, it's a movie with a lot of faith, and underlying that is a sort of, like, potential nihilism, and that's what's scary about it, right? I mean, it's not the pea soup. That's startling, but it's not necessarily scary.
And pea soup type stuff is the type, this is, like, gives you a release where there's a scream or a jump or a scare, and it lets you release, you know, okay, now that's over with, but then it starts building again, so it's like a roller coaster to a certain extent. Adrenaline rush, I think, too.
We've got about 15, a little less than 15 minutes.
We'll take questions.
Yeah, sure.
All right.
Yes.
Over the last year, what have been some good influences that you have drawn from to inspire your horror creations or horror in your campaigns?
For me, it's I just live and breathe like horror movies and stuff like that. There's been a lot of really. Both in mass market type stuff and independent horror movies have been really effective. We mentioned The Witch earlier. It Follows has been really just a creepy, creepy movie. And then on up to like really big, big movies like The Conjuring was a movie that was like a huge, huge release that did just really. Get Out just came out earlier this
year. So good.
And it's
comedy too.
It is. It's comedy at the same point. Yeah, it's absolutely. It's a case where it's like comedy and horror working perfectly side by side. But Get Out does something that, you know, looks at the horror of racism. And before the buildup, there was, you know, a lot of like not conspiracy, but people like, oh, it's just a racism movie and all of that. And it's a lot deeper than that. It's about, to a certain extent, it's about the fear of being racist, which is a really subtle difference that is really creepy and compelling to just watch and experience. The Exorcist TV show had no right to be as good as it was. Because I didn't watch the first one, and I think maybe it was you that mentioned, James, you should probably watch the show.
Yeah.
And I started watching it. It's like every episode come along, it's just like, first of all, it's on network TV. The same thing with Hannibal.
Yeah.
Network TV. So you're like, they're not going to do that. Oh, they did that. they did that too.
So Hannibal was great because it was both a beautifully constructed, visually beautiful, scripts were beautiful, the acting
was beautiful.
Yeah.
People were beautiful. It dealt with a concept that, you know, speaking of inspirations lately, like, I'm fascinated by and glad that movies and TV are finally acknowledging, which is the phenomenon of moral injury, which is basically, they're studying Vietnam vets, they started finding vets with PTSD who hadn't been in the sort of situations that normally they associated with PTSD. Like, they hadn't had near-death experiences, they hadn't been severely injured, they hadn't had one of their comrades die in front of them, but they were showing all the same symptoms. And what they found out they had in common was all these people had been forced to do something that went against their internal moral code. And which was where they got the concept of moral injury, right? And so, like, Jessica Jones is about that. Mm-hmm. Hannibal is about that. The Hunger Games is largely mm-hmm. about that. Mm-hmm.
Those are all great examples of this sublime. Because Hannibal, you yeah. watch Hannibal, and it's like, it's you're looking at that is a beautiful roast, and you know it's, I'm not the same exposure, but you know it's someone's leg. And you're like, oh. But it looks so pretty.
Yeah. And one of the fascinating things about Hannibal is it functions on this really profound level, and it is, at the same time, an epic trolling of TV censors.
Yes.
Because, like, at one point, they have this very beautiful and horrifying tableau of these people who've basically been blood-eagled. Like, they've been split open, and their ribs, and like, wings, and they're posed like angels. So it is both horrifying and composed to be really yeah. beautiful, and yeah. the censors were like, we can see their butts, so you can't put that on TV. And Brian Fuller was like, well, what if I filled their butt cracks with blood? And they were like, yeah, that right, so it kind of exposes the arbitrariness yeah. of TV yeah. censorship. Yeah. But yeah, so
I think as far as inspiration in recent years, I've been drawn to a lot of post-apocalyptic narratives. Mm-hmm. So, like, The Last of Us, I think, is one of the best games that has been out in probably the past 5 years or so. I love that game, and I've played through that game so much because that game is so, it's so emotionally rich, and that is where the horror really comes from, because you have this character who starts out, and he's not really a very good guy, he's kind of a jerk, he's sort of out for himself, and then he gets paired with Ellie, who, you know, has this tragic backstory, and, you know, is just trying to, like, figure out how she's going to survive, and then all of these things happen. I don't want to give spoilers, but you get very attached to these characters, and you get very attached to watching them take care of each other, and watching them just navigate this world that is totally blasted, not only, you know, by the actual, like, zombie apocalypse that's happened, but also by the way the humans have reacted to it, and the way that there are these quarantines, and the government has shut everything down, and so there are all of these coalescing you know, conflicts that are coming through, and at the center are the characters, and I feel like that is a super compelling type of narrative, especially for RPG design, because that shows you how to build a world in which the characters might have one or two or three or four avenues, but they've got to do it together. They've got to get through it together, otherwise there are all of these forces just waiting to rip them apart. The Walking Dead is very much like that as well, which is another series that we got very into as a TV show. I'm doing a lot of Starfinder, and would be remiss if I did not mention the Dead Space series, which is also very similar, in which, you know, it's especially the first one, it's the ship that has had something terrible happen to it, and the crew is all missing, and there's these terrible bloody tableaus, and, you know, they've morphed into these creatures, and you're just a guy who's stuck on here trying to survive, trying to wait for somebody to come help him, and also being assaulted, you know, in his mind by, you know, this thing that you don't find out until the end has been affecting him throughout his whole journey. So I really find a lot of inspiration in properties and narratives in which, you know, the characters have to overcome all of these horrific elements and try to figure out who they are so that they can figure out how to survive.
If you haven't, don't have, like, a PlayStation 3 and haven't played or seen The Last of Us, which is, I think, probably, it's one of the top three games I've ever played.
It's been remastered for PS4.
Yeah, so, well, if you're stuck in Xbox, like some of us. Check out The Girl with All the Gifts. The movie just recently came out. It's shockingly good. I mean, it starts out really low key, and it's a case where it's like, this looks like a low budget kind of indie movie, and it's good.
The book's really good.
Yeah. I was gonna say, like, the past probably the past 5 years, honestly, since working at Paizo, has really helped me figure out what sort of horror I don't enjoy, too, getting back to that consent thing.
Yeah.
Like, I thought I didn't like horror, and then, you know, I started hanging out with Wes and James, and they're both really into it, and they showed me a lot of different types of horror, and it was like, oh, there's certain things that I don't like. I don't like zombie stuff. Like there's some of it that I'm okay with, but in general, like it doesn't make me scared. It makes me incredibly sad because like the idea of that you might lose somebody you love and they might become your enemy and there's no way to get them back is for me, and not because they've died, they're still there, but now they're, you know, now they're dangerous to you. It's just not, you know, it's certainly horrific to me, but not in that way that, you know, there is no pleasure in it for me, and so I don't really like it. I could ended up not being able to do The Man in the High Castle. Like, I was just like, I can't, I'm out. I'm waiting until I'm like in the right emotional space to do The Handmaid's Tale, because that's horror.
We can talk about that.
Yeah. And I mean, honestly, it's not intended as horror. I still haven't watched Schindler's List. Like, in college, my first editing gig was working for a press that did a lot of Holocaust memoirs. So, like, the first thing I learned to edit was Holocaust memoirs, which are horror.
Yeah.
And not in any way that's pleasurable. And so, like, you know, it's like, I know I should see Schindler's List. It's a classic movie, but I'm just like, I've done my time. I can't. And, you know, I mean, that was kind of, not in the same way, but that was kind of where The Man in the High Castle was for me. I was just like, nope. And so, like, once you know, like, there has to be pleasure in it, otherwise all it is something that's going to make you feel terrible. Like, honestly, one of the reasons you watch horror movies is for catharsis, because you can feel you can feel fear, you can feel dread, you can feel terror, but there's no real-world consequences for you. And, like, when we talk about trigger warnings, that's basically what it is. You don't want to force real-world consequences on somebody.
Could I just put in I've run horror games before, and something that I found really helpful is aftercare.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that is, because you've gone through some serious crap with people, and you can't just go, all right, everybody, see you next week.
Yeah.
Sometimes you need a little de-stressing, whether it's like, let's turn the lights up, let's put some music on, or let's just talk about what happened. It doesn't have to be a full encounter session, but just like, you have to acknowledge, we just did some really heavy emotional stuff.
Yep.
Let's get it out. Okay, now we'll go back with our lives.
Yep,
yeah.
That's a great point. Got time for a few
questions.
More short questions, but we talk a lot.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about how you would integrate horror role-playing with Pathfinder? Like, one of the things that I find, because it is a heroic game, it assumes combat, things like that, that some of those can, that in essence can have some of the relief built in.
Yeah.
You know, if you can kill the evil thing suddenly,
yeah,
that is a release. But, you know, how do you make the two compatible?
So, as I mentioned, denial of agency is a huge one. Like, taking away some of their powers, like magic suddenly doesn't work, or they don't have their weapons.
Like the Strange Aeons Adventure Path, for example, you start out and you, in that case, you have your agency taken away because the adventure starts with you in a prison cell and you can't remember the last 5 years of your life. And so part of the adventure path is figuring out what you've been up to over the past 5 years and why you started in this prison cell. And so really look at like Strange Aeons. We've done some horror-themed adventures like Curse of the Crimson Throne. Actually, has some creepy stuff with plagues and stuff like that. Carrion Crown is a good one. Carrion Hill, anything with more carrion in the title.
Red flag, horror.
So it's, yeah, that's really what it is denial, or not denial, removing the agency and upending the expectations and all of that. And you don't want to, if you're still playing Pathfinder, you don't want to necessarily make it always bad. And you want to give people their chances at success and all that, because hope is something that keeps you going too. And I mean, yeah, just check out, I think another thing we talked a little bit about movie inspirations, check out like movies that are, you know, fantasy movies that are sort of have horror themes and stuff like that. They're harder to come by, but they do exist. There's one called Black Death about what's his name, who's always dying in movies.
Sean Bean.
Sean Bean. Yeah. No, it's bad.
It's just bad.
Like, knowing what happens.
Yeah, so
that's what I would say. The Dark Tower actually is a great example. That's got a movie coming out this year.
Yeah.
But that's one of the big inspirations for me, because, you know, Stephen King taking on like the fantasy and science fiction, but through a horror viewpoint, and at the same point, this really meta thing where he's a character in the series of the stories, and it just messes with expectations.
You can see a lot of that psychological a lot of the psychological sort of unrest that is at the core of a horror game in a Pathfinder game, just like you could in a Dread game or just like you could in a Call of Cthulhu game. You know, the rules are not built for it, but as a GM, you can construct your game around those things in which you're seeding just little things. Carrying Crown does a great job in the first adventure. I don't know if you're familiar with it at all. Yeah, so those random encounters where the PCs will just come across little kids that are chanting about, you know, the Red Slasher or whatever the name of the serial killer is in that, or, you know, just weird little, like, bloody footprints that are, you know, leading up to the fountain and then stop. So little things like that, rumors that they might hear, things that they might see in the bar, stuff that they might, you know, come across in any way, or just little stuff like what James was saying, where it's just like, okay, you're going through an abandoned, you know, old manor or something, and make a perception check, you know. You don't think you see anything. You think you might hear a creak, but there's no creature.
You can even give them things like you find a little kid's whistle or something like that. And when we're talking about fantasy horror, which like Game of Thrones is actually, is horror in a lot of cases. Dragons and there's, you know, knights and swords and stuff like that. But there's a lot of there's like zombies. There's a lot of really grim stuff happening. It's
a lot of terrible people doing terrible things.
Yeah. So I mean, that's really
people are the
most fantastic. Yeah, people are the best monsters and the worst monsters. So. Let's do one more quick question.
Quick question. Actually, it's two parts. One. Have you ever played Trail of Cthulhu?
What?
Have you ever played Trail of Cthulhu?
I have not played it, but I've read through it and all that.
So because you're a Cthulhu guy, so I thought you might. Mm-hmm. Getting back to kind of taking away your stuff, and because I'm having kind of the same problem, is when you're running a horror campaign and you just start getting like significantly higher levels and trying to maintain that level of dread or horror or whatever, without having to basically punish your players all the time, like, oh yeah, dude, I gotta take your staff away again or else I can't get the adventure done. You know, how do you
extent, that's kind of just keeping track of things as you go, and if something seems to get out of hand, you can even talk to a player and say, like, hey, that staff ends up being too powerful. Curses are a great thing. I mean, just look at, like, the ring in Lord of the Rings. That thing lets you go invisible, and you can do a lot of mana when you're invisible, but every time you put it on, Sauron can watch you, so that type of thing really matters. Check out Best 36. There's a lot of stuff in there that's really powerful and frightening.
Also, think about the monkey's paw, right?
Yes.
Your power has consequences, and everything you do ends up unexpectedly making things worse.
Oh, good.
Or the box.
Afraid of their gear.
Or the box.
The boxes,
Yeah, or doing weird things to the gear, like they've been adventuring in this area where there's a lot of haunts and stuff. You know, some of the energy is getting into some of the magic items or strange happenings going on. They don't know if it's from their sword. They don't know if it's because it's all in their head. And then it starts to become a lot just creepier and more.
We've got to go real quick. But that just reminded me, that's the great thing to do. If you give them a magic item that is really powerful, if you give that magic item like a sort of an intelligence or something like that, like maybe every time they use it, the adventure path, or every time they use the magic item, you're like, all right, just write their name on the wall, and you put on like whiteboard or something, and you just start doing hash marks. May not mean anything. You can also say, like, give out a really powerful weapon to, say, I don't know, Amanda. It's like, here's your powerful sword. Oh, it's intelligent, and the stolen item is super misogynist.
He did that to me, you guys.
Remember that anticipation and dread are basically the same thing. It's just what you're anticipating. And so, like, one of the most effective marketing tools is a countdown.
Yep.
One of the most effective tools for creating dread is a countdown.
Yeah. So, like, if you just start keeping track of, like, the amount of times a person uses it, or every time you use it, have them make a perception check, and no matter what they roll, they're never going to roll high enough. They're going to start doubting what they're using. Using it. Yeah. Okay.
Awesome, thank you so much. Thank you for joining us for another edition of the No Direction Podcast PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage, made possible with the help of Justin Sluder and Ryan Hiller of Geek Dad. To find more great Pathfinder audio, go to NoDirectionPodcast.com.